Those who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Dasha, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, January 9th issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. One of the stories on the front page: Maduro ouster leaves Cuba desperate, closer to collapse, by Deborah Acosta and Jose de Corba. Elderly Cubans are digging through garbage for scraps of food in Havana. In the country's second city, Santiago, crowds have gathered, blaring music by Cuban exiles such as Gloria Estefan and Willy Chirino, who sings "Our Day Is Coming Soon." The U.S. ouster of Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro has jolted this country of fewer than 10 million people, which has long relied on Venezuela for oil imports that have barely kept its tiny economy from collapsing. It opens a new and perilous chapter for the island's communist regime during an economic implosion that rivals the crisis suffered by Cuba after the collapse of the Soviet Union more than three decades ago. In poorer cities, people are openly speculating about whether the U.S. will topple the government of Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel, the successor of Raúl and Fidel Castro, the siblings who led the Cuban Revolution in 1959 that sent shockwaves across Latin America. "They're nervous," Manuel Cuesta Murúa, a Havana-based political activist, said of the government. "Repression will increase. It's a typical response." Cuba's state security apparatus has long had a tight grip on all levels of society, from workplaces to schools or concert halls. But Maduro's capture risks upending the government's control of every street, its deep surveillance system, and its vast network of snitches, Cuban dissidents, and former officials, said. 2 days after Maduro's ouster, Reynaldo Flores was dealing with his fifth consecutive day without running water at his apartment in Havana. It was his new normal, along with the daily blackouts, the failing healthcare system, the trash piled high along the streets, and his aching joints from the mosquito-borne illnesses that have plagued the islands. 6, 7 days ago, 10 days go by with no water, said 66-year-old Flores. Then, when the water returns, there's no electricity to pump it in. Recently, he said, there was one day where he simultaneously had no electricity, no running water, and no gas with which to cook. Like all Cubans, Flores saves water in a tank, rationing it for drinking, cooking, washing, and bathing. When it runs out, he jumps from one rooftop to another to gather buckets of water from nearby cisterns. He worries most about the elderly looking for food in the garbage. When they contract a virus, they go to overwhelmed hospitals to die. All of that is occurring without taking into account the stifling heat. "One of my friends works for the government and was just tasked with picking up elderly people who live alone, who'd been dead in their homes for days," said Flores, who's retired and relies on remittances from relatives abroad. Cuba has been in a perpetual economic crisis, which has intensified since the COVID-19 pandemic. More than 2.7 million people, about a quarter of the island's population, the majority of them young and ambitious, have fled the island since 2020, most to the U.S. It is demographic hollowing out, Cuban demographer Juan Carlos Albizu Campos said. He estimated Cuba's population is now 8 million. The combined result of mass emigration and decreased female fertility is that live births in Cuba plunged to levels below that of 1899, when Cuba emerged from a bloody three-year war of independence that decimated its population, said Albizu Campos. Cuba's problem was already existential, said Joe Garcia, a former Cuban-American congressman who speaks often with senior island officials. On the Cuban side is desperation, and worse desperation, said Garcia, a Florida Democrat. Tourism, Once one of the island's economic pillars has plummeted, with hotel occupancy hovering below 30%, industry executives said. Most tourists, the majority from Russia and China, arrive with all-inclusive packages, meaning that spending doesn't trickle down to ordinary Cubans, as visitors don't spend much outside their pre-approved itinerary. A new 42-story luxury hotel towers over the once elegant Vedado district in Havana, Cuba's capital. Yet the $200 million Spanish-run hotel is nearly empty, said William Leo Grande, a Cuba analyst at Washington's American University, who recently returned from the country. He estimated that hard currency income from tourism is down 75%. Many Cubans rely on remittances from family members abroad. The state relies on billions of dollars collected by the government from thousands of Cuban doctors working in Venezuela, Mexico, and other countries, and subsidized Venezuelan oil imports to keep the lights on. But now the Venezuelan oil spigot could be shut off by the U.S. Cuba has no money to buy oil on international markets and can only hope that friendly countries such as Angola, Algeria, Brazil, or Colombia will make up the shortfall if Venezuela, under U.S. pressure, cuts off its supplies, said Jorge de Arpiñon, who tracks Cuba's energy consumption at the University of Texas. Venezuela has been providing some 35,000 barrels of oil a day in the estimated 100,000 barrels a day the island needs. Cuba produces about 40,000 barrels a day of sulfur and metals-laden heavy crude that feeds the country's decrepit power plants. Mexico, which sent about 22,000 barrels a day to Cuba last year, has since lowered shipments to some 7,000, while Russia sends about 10,000 barrels a day, he said. Cutting off Venezuelan oil would devastate Cuba's economy. I would not be surprised if the Americans tell Venezuela to continue giving oil to Cuba so as not to open another Pandora's box, said Piñon, who calculates oil shipments to the island using reports from services that track tanker movements. Without Venezuelan oil, he estimated Cuba's energy infrastructure would collapse within 30 days. As the country struggles to survive, the big question will be the response of Cuba's leadership, which has ruled with an iron fist since the revolution, led by the Castros and their bearded men in olive green. The first action of the communist regime was to require workers to attend a rally over the weekend to denounce Maduro's capture and declare 2 days of mourning with flags at half-staff, honoring the 32 Cuban soldiers and high-ranking military intelligence officers who died during the U.S. military incursion. Without oil, there's a risk that the rolling blackouts, which sometimes leave island residents with only 4 hours of electricity a day, will worsen. Those who have relied on generators to get by will have a hard time running them without access to fuel. Even cooking will be complicated, as some residents have turned to petroleum-run stoves to cook their food. Leo Grande said that unlike the crisis after the Soviet collapse, a time known as the special period, when economic pain was felt across Cuban society, the hardship in this crisis is falling disproportionately on poorer Cubans who don't have relatives abroad who send them dollars. There is more visible inequality, Leo Grande said. Poor people are as bad off as in the special period, but a segment of the middle and upper class have access to dollars and are not in such bad shape, which causes real social tension. More world news that Gabbard sidelined from Venezuela planning for months. White House officials excluded the top U.S. intelligence officer, Tulsi Gabbard, from Venezuela planning since last summer, people with knowledge of the matter said. As President Trump's national security team huddled last week to make final preparations for the operation to snatch Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, Gabbard was posting social media photos of herself on a beach in Hawaii, where she grew up. Trump isn't particularly close with Gabbard, a senior administration official said, and wanted to limit the number of people who knew about the Venezuela mission. She didn't need to know about it, the official said. Gabbard's office provided, quote, intelligence analysis that assisted in the overall mission from the analytical side, end quote, a second administration official said. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was among the top officials who preferred Gabbard remain sidelined from the discussions, two of the people with knowledge of the situation said. Gabbard, Rubio, and President Trump's entire team have worked together in lockstep to deliver on his agenda, said Tommy Pigott, a State Department spokesman. This is a tired and false narrative, attempting to promote a fake story of division when there is none. The move highlights the increasing isolation and the turbulent tenure of Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, amid her struggle to penetrate the president's inner circle and influence policies. Trump has grown increasingly reliant on Central Intelligence Agency Director John Ratcliffe for key intelligence consultations. That's completely false, Vice President J.D. Vance said when asked about Gabbard's exclusion from the Venezuela planning during a Thursday White House briefing. We kept it very tight to the senior cabinet-level officials and related officials in our government. For years, Gabbard had been an outspoken critic of foreign interventions and had accused Trump during his first administration of bowing to neoconservatives who favored acting against Venezuela and coveted the country's oil reserves. The second administration official said it was, quote, unfair to focus on Gabbard's previous views, given other Trump administration officials have also previously voiced disagreement on policy or even slammed the president directly. The official said Gabbard leads routine intelligence briefings for the president and is often at the White House. Gabbard's exclusion from the Venezuela planning began last year when Trump grew impatient with Maduro and White House officials began drawing up military options to remove him. Underpinning these were intelligence assessments of Venezuela's military and political realities, communications intercepts, and human intelligence collection, and the August insertion of CIA personnel around Caracas. President Trump has full confidence in his entire exceptional national security team, White House Communications Director Stephen Chung said. Gabbard had angered Trump in June as the U.S. was planning to strike Iran's nuclear weapons program. Earlier in the year, she had said during a congressional testimony that the U.S. intelligence community had assessed that Iran was not building a nuclear weapon. I don't care what she said, Trump told reporters on Air Force One. Gabbard appeared to recover after declassifying documents relating to the intelligence community's probe into alleged links between Russia and Trump's 2016 campaign. She and other Trump officials said these documents offered proof of an anti-Trump conspiracy in the intelligence community, and the president praised her efforts in cabinet meetings. In August, she surprised the CIA by including an undercover senior agency officer on a public list of 37 current and former officials stripped of their security clearances. The roster included people who had worked on issues related to Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election or had signed a 2019 letter calling for President Trump's impeachment. Normally a voluble supporter of Trump's policies, Gabbard was initially silent on the Venezuela operation before posting 3 days after it. President Trump promised the American people he would secure our borders, confront narco-terrorism, dangerous drug cartels, and drug traffickers, Gabbard posted Tuesday on X. Kudos to our servicemen and women and intelligence operators for their flawless execution of President Trump's order to deliver on his promise through Operation Absolute Resolve. In Lebanon, the military steps up the disarmament plan. Lebanon's military on Thursday said it had concluded the first phase of a plan to fully deploy across southern Lebanon and disarm non-state groups, notably Hezbollah. Israel said the development was encouraging, but far from sufficient, and its foreign ministry said the group still has dozens of compounds and other infrastructure. The effort to disarm Hezbollah comes after a Washington-brokered ceasefire halted a war between the group and Israel in 2024. The military statement came before President Joseph Aoun met with Prime Minister Nawaf Salam and his government to discuss the deployment and disarmament plans. Both said disarming non-state groups was a priority upon beginning their terms not long after the ceasefire went into effect. And in Russia, a French scholar was released in a swap, Laurent Vinitier, a French political scholar serving a 3-year sentence in Russia and facing new charges of espionage, has been freed in a prisoner swap with France, officials said on Thursday. In exchange, Russian basketball player Daniil Kostatsin, jailed in France and whose extradition was demanded by the U.S., was released and returned to Russia on Thursday, Russia's Federal Security Service said. Vinatier was arrested in Moscow in June 2024. Russian authorities accused him of failing to register as a foreign agent while collecting information about Russia's military and military technical activities that could be used to the detriment of national security. A court convicted him and sentenced him to a 3-year prison term. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In the column Capital Account by Greg Ipp, low risk, low reward in U.S. oil move. President Trump spent the last year taking economic stakes in private companies. To start the new year, he's done that with an entire country. This week, the Trump administration said it would control sales of Venezuela's oil, of which the U.S. will get 30 million to 50 million barrels. That effectively grafts Trump's mercantile approach to domestic policy onto foreign policy. The cash flow-obsessed Trump should like the numbers so far, given the low cost and absence of U.S. casualties to date. Toppling Nicolas Maduro might prove to be profitable. Whether this is a logical basis for U.S. policy is another matter. To be sure, past American intervention often had economic motives, such as keeping the global oil supply out of hostile hands. The threat of the oil weapon was pervasive from the 1970s through the early 1990s, when Donald Trump formed his worldview. But the world has changed, and controlling Venezuela's oil has only modest and uncertain benefits. The U.S. became a net oil exporter in 2020. Because of efficiency, natural gas, and renewables, and the falling share of energy-intensive sectors, global consumption of oil per unit of economic output has fallen by more than half since 1979, according to the World Bank. Today, it's technology that makes or breaks nations. It was a shortage of semiconductors that brought automobile assembly to a halt early in the pandemic. The U.S. spends more on imports of computers and electronics than oil. Its big tech companies are far more powerful abroad than its oil companies. The Magnificent Seven earn roughly 10 times as much on foreign sales as the three big oil companies. That 30 million to 50 million barrels of oil Trump expects from Venezuela are worth $1.5 billion to $2.5 billion, assuming $50 a barrel. For comparison, I reckon the 25% cut Trump extracted from NVIDIA in return for permission to sell advanced artificial intelligence chips to China could be worth as much as $5 billion a year, set aside for now the tenuous legal basis for both. Optimistically, Venezuela could boost daily output to 1.35 million barrels a day in 24 months, from 826,000 in 2025, according to Jim Burkhard at S&P Global Energy, after netting out imported diluent. Assume operating costs of as much as $20 a barrel, and that Venezuela charges no royalty at first, that yields annual revenue of $15 billion. A 50% royalty rate would slash that in half. For the U.S., this is a trivial sum. Domestic oil and gas production contributes $240 billion a year, mostly in profits and wages to gross domestic product, and $14 billion a year in fees and royalties to the Federal Treasury. Trump is keenly focused on the benefit to oil companies, which stand to recover billions in expropriated assets and new access. Yet even for them, the potential revenue isn't transformative. ExxonMobil, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips have combined annual sales exceeding $500 billion. And then there are the costs. Venezuela's oil infrastructure is dilapidated from decades of socialism and sanction under Maduro and his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. S&P Global Energy's Burkhardt offers a very rough estimate of $20 billion to boost output by 500,000 barrels a day. Trump has acknowledged the federal government might have to, quote, reimburse, end quote, some of that investment. That's including costs for making the country safe. The U.S. has spent $1.4 billion to $1.6 billion interdicting drug boats and capturing Maduro, estimates Elaine McCusker, a former Pentagon budget official now at the American Enterprise Institute. If the U.S. never puts boots on the ground, this will turn out to be cheap compared with nation building in Afghanistan and Iraq. But will the Chavistas, who still run Venezuela, remain cooperative? If a substantial U.S. military presence becomes necessary, the costs would rise sharply. Controlling territory abroad is expensive, as past imperialists discovered. One reason the U.S. turned the Panama Canal over to Panama in a 1977 treaty was that the cost, including a sizable troop presence, exceeded the economic and strategic benefit, said Noel Maurer, a professor of international affairs and business at George Washington University. There's money to be made in Venezuela, and the U.S. should want the American oil companies to get it, said Maurer. It's not clear what benefit there is to anyone outside the oil industry. The change in Venezuela won't reduce global oil prices much, he said. The administration has also advanced non-financial motives, evicting Russia, Cuba, and China from a neighbor. The U.S. could also deny China access to Venezuelan oil, in which it has invested heavily. China has plenty of alternative suppliers. It also is far along in the development of and the adoption of electric vehicles, which will reduce its imports of oil. Meanwhile, China is practicing doing to Taiwan just what the U.S. did to Venezuela, imposing a blockade. Given Taiwan's dominance producing the world's most advanced semiconductors, that is a risk magnitudes more urgent than anything going on in America's backyard. In other front page news, Chinese automaker Geely aims to make cars in the U.S. by Ryan Felton. China auto giant Geely is eyeing an expansion into the U.S. in what would be a watershed moment for domestic car makers that viewed Chinese brands as an existential threat. Zhejiang Geely Holding Group is mostly likely to make an announcement about a U.S. expansion within the next 24 to 36 months, said Ash Sutcliffe, Geely's global communications chief.
Well, the big question for us is when and where will we go to the U.S., Sutcliffe said in an interview this week with Autoline Network at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Geely controls a broad portfolio of brands that make popular electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, and gas-powered cars. Geely's expansion in the U.S. would represent the first major move by a Chinese brand to come into the country, which has imposed hefty tariffs on imports of Chinese-made vehicles and has a ban on Chinese-connected vehicle software in cars set to go into effect for the 2027 model year. Chinese automakers have swallowed up market share in other countries around the world, a worrisome prospect for U.S. car executives who struggle to compete on production costs and vehicle technology. Unlike other Chinese competitors, Geely already has a small foothold in the U.S. as the majority owner of Sweden's Volvo, which it acquired from Ford Motor in 2010. Waymo, the alphabet-owned self-driving car company, is also deploying on U.S. streets an outfitted robotaxi made by Zeekr, another Chinese brand controlled by Geely. Sutcliffe said in the interview that Geely, Zeekr, and Lincoln Company could be good fits for the U.S. market.
We would look at these brands, he said.
Geely hasn't yet sought out a production site in the U.S., Sutcliffe said, but suggested that Volvo's assembly plant in South Carolina could be a prospective location.
If we wanted to work with them, we would approach Volvo Cars and see if we could share their facility, he said.
A Volvo spokesperson said the automaker doesn't have any plans to build Geely cars at the South Carolina plant. Sutcliffe said that Geely would work with the regulatory environment in the U.S. As a global company, it's your duty to follow these rules and regulations, Sutcliffe said of the software ban. Sutcliffe said he couldn't comment about the Autoline Network interview. Geely's media relations team in China didn't respond to requests for comment. Geely coming to the U.S. would be smart and strategic, given its success in China, said Dan Ives, managing director and senior equity analyst at Wedbush Securities. There's a window for Chinese EVs to hit the U.S. market, but the concern is the Trump administration will not be happy campers about this move and could block or restrict it, Ives said. For years, U.S. executives and industry groups have cast a Chinese automotive incursion to the U.S. as a major threat to the long-term stability of domestic car brands. Ford chief executive Jim Farley has sounded a similar alarm about how advanced China's car industry has become. The automaker based in Dearborn, Michigan, is planning to launch a $30,000 EV pickup truck next year to answer the rise of Chinese brands selling cheaper electrified models. The Alliance for Automotive Innovation, a group that represents most major automakers, has urged Congress and the Trump administration to prevent Chinese government-backed automakers from gaining entry to manufacture in the U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno, Republican of Ohio, a Trump ally and former car dealer, derided news of Geely's intention to come into the U.S. in a post on X. No Chinese cars in America and definitely no Trojan horses, Moreno said. But China's auto industry keeps growing. China's BYD topped Tesla to become the world's biggest EV seller last year, fueled by electric vehicles in regions around the world. Geely reported strong earnings for the most recent quarter, despite increasing competition in China, with net profit jumping 59% compared with a year earlier. The company raised its annual sales target to 3 million vehicles. Meanwhile, Adam Bernard, founder of consulting firm Auto Perspectives, briefly took a test drive of the Geely-owned Lincoln Company 09 Sport utility vehicle on Monday while at CES. Bernard, a former associate director of competitor intelligence at General Motors, said the vehicle could hold cart with domestic car makers. Yeah, they're as good as anything a legacy automaker can build, or better. Under U.S. watch, in New York City, leaders have unveiled a free childcare plan. New York City parents may soon have access to free childcare for their two-year-olds under a plan unveiled Thursday by Governor Kathy Hochul and Mayor Zoran Mamdani. This is the day that everything changes, Hochul said, also debuting a proposal to expand statewide access to childcare in the coming years. The governor said she was committing to funding the first 2 years of the city's free childcare program for two-year-olds, describing it as an expansion of the city's existing universal pre-K and 3K programs. The first year will focus on high-need areas selected by the city, then expand across the city to its fourth year, according to the statement. Mamdani said he expected the program to cover about 2,000 children this fall and then continue to expand until it becomes a universal program. In New Jersey, a new law curbs use of phones in school. On Thursday, New Jersey joined a growing list of states to limit cell phone use by students during the day. Democratic Governor Phil Murphy signed legislation requiring the State Education Commission and local school boards to come up with guidelines for the use of cell phones in schools for grades K-12. The new law specifically requires the prohibition of non-academic uses of internet-connected devices, including phones, during the school day. Murphy called for the ban early last year. The prohibition is set to go into effect with the 2026-27 school year. Including New Jersey, 37 states and the District of Columbia now have laws or rules limiting phones and other electronic devices in schools. And back in China, church leaders held a mid-crackdown Authorities are widening a crackdown on Christian groups, this week detaining church leaders in the southwestern China, as officials intensify a campaign to root out religious organizations beyond the state's control. The detentions at Early Rain Covenant Church, a prominent, unapproved Protestant group in Sichuan Province, took place on Tuesday, this church and overseas human rights groups said. The church said that as of Wednesday night, at least four people associated with the church had been taken away, while two others were missing. They include church elder Li Yangcheng and his wife, as well as preacher Dai Xingcheng. Authorities in Sichuan didn't reply to a request for comment, and it couldn't be learned whether any of those detained had been formally charged. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In the business and finance section, Musk's Grok under fire for photos of children by Georgia Wells. Elon Musk has repeatedly expanded the boundaries of permitted speech on his social media platform X. Child safety watchdogs and international regulators say a recent update to his AI chatbot Grok crossed a dangerous line, permitting sexualizing editing of photos, including of children. Now Musk, who's called himself a free speech absolutist, while also vowing to take a hard line on child exploitation, faces growing calls for enforcement around the world and in the U.S. In late December, XAI's chatbot Grok began allowing users to edit images with text prompts. People on Musk's social media platform X discovered they could use the feature to execute instructions such as take her clothes off and put her in a bikini. Non-consensual and AI-generated images of women in underwear flooded X. Grok generated about 7,750 sexually suggestive or nudifying images in an hour in an analysis of its content on X on Wednesday, according to Jean-Yves O, a social media and deepfake researcher. Copy Leaks, a company that identifies when images have been altered with AI, said it was detecting one non-consensual sexualized image a minute in Grok's publicly accessible photo stream in late December. Some users focused the tool on children. XAI and Musk didn't respond to requests for comment. Nger Alexandra, head of the hotline at the Internet Watch Foundation, said the nonprofit's analyst discovered sexualized images of minors in a dark web forum whose members said they'd used Grok to produce the images. Alexander, whose organization identifies sexual abuse content online, said the images depicted sexualized and topless girls who appeared to be between the ages of 11 and 13. The images appeared to meet the UK's criteria for criminal child sexual abuse material, the IWF said. Material that exploits and sexualizes children has existed online since the creation of the internet and in analog formats before that. But artificial intelligence and apps such as Grok have accelerated the speed and ease with which people can generate photorealistic, sexualized images of children. Tools like Grok now risk bringing sexual AI imagery of children into the mainstream, Alexander said. The harms are rippling out. Previously, Musk indicated he would address child safety on his program. After he bought Twitter in 2022, Musk said in a post that eliminating child exploitation was priority number one. He encouraged visitors to reply in the comments of his post if they saw anything in his company needed to address. XAI is among the major tech companies competing to attract users and funding as they race to develop cutting-edge artificial intelligence tools. Executives at XAI have repeatedly found that offering AI tools with looser guardrails around sexual content than other platforms has helped drive engagement, according to people familiar with the changes. On January 2nd, as furor over the proliferation of non-consensual images mounted, Musk reposted an image on X of a toaster in a bikini. Not sure why, but I couldn't stop laughing about this one, Musk said in his post. The next day, he posted that anyone using Grok to make illegal content would suffer the same consequences as if they were to upload illegal content. An account for Grok on X said XAI has safeguards against depicting minors in minimal clothing, and improvements are ongoing to block such requests entirely. Around the world, regulators said they're taking action or are considering next steps, including in the European Commission, UK, France, Australia, Malaysia, India, and Brazil. There is an explosion of AI generating explicit images of children, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, wrote in a post on X responding to a post about Grok. She urged Congress to pass legislation she has spearheaded designed to help victims of deepfakes. People on X responded to Ocasio-Cortez's post with deepfake images of her in a bikini. The National Center on Sexual Exploitation, a nonprofit that has urged improved child safety protections online and has sought to restrict access to pornography, called on the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission to investigate X. Ashley St. Clair, a conservative influencer who had a child with Musk, said in an interview that users on X were using Grok to undress images of her, including one from when she was 14. St. Clair sued Musk in February over custody and financial support of their child. St. Clair put out a call to other users in a post on X to notify her if they experienced similar treatment. She said she has been inundated with messages from desperate parents trying to get the sexualized images of their children taken down. I've watched Elon stop much less with a single message to his engineers, she said, including when his jokes weren't performing well on X. Musk has drawn both fans and criticism for his effort to create an anti-woke chat box. Over the summer, his chatbot posted a range of anti-Semitic comments and referred to itself as Mecha Hitler in a series of viral posts on X. Following the incident, XAI said it was actively working to remove the inappropriate posts, and X said if it had tweaked its functionality to ensure it wouldn't post hate speech. Grok was too compliant to user prompts, too eager to please and being manipulated, essentially, Musk said in a post at the time. In mid-2025, Thorn, a nonprofit that creates detection tools for child safety, said it canceled its contract with X after Musk's company stopped paying. Many major tech companies rely on Thorn's tools to detect and remove child sexual abuse content. Internally, XAI's decisions to loosen the rules on its platform have caused tension among employees. Former employees involved in the launch of Annie, a racy animated character on Grok with blonde pigtails and revealing outfits, and a spicy mode, a setting that lets users create suggestive and sexualized content, said the offerings spurred engagement with the app. Some employees raised concerns that spicy mode would be used for harassment, according to people familiar with the matter. Former employees of Musk said Musk has in the past been at odds with some executives about how much they should restrict content. People who have voiced concerns have been driven out of the company, they said. In the weeks before XAI released the new way to edit images, XAI lost a number of people working on its small teams dedicated to safety, including its head of product safety and its head of legal affairs, according to the former employees. In late December, an employee of XAI said in a post that the company was hiring for its safety team. In Heard on the Street, could AI drag down incomes? Now that the U.S. government shutdown has faded into the rearview mirror, we're back to our regularly scheduled monthly jobs math. That mostly involves addition and division. How many employees did companies or the government hire? And what percentage of the labor force is looking for a job? Payroll growth probably was modest in December, but the unemployment rate is estimated to have dropped slightly to 4.5%, according to economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal. So, basically okay? Actually, we might be missing some important nuance for the U.S. economy. Growth and profits are determined by how much money people have to spend, not just how many of them are drawing a regular paycheck. Are Americans able to negotiate raises, and what sorts of jobs are they landing? On the wage negotiation front, Wednesday's report on job openings and turnover brought unwelcome news. The rate of quitting, a sign of how confident workers are that there are better roles out there, was the lowest in nearly 6 years. The other trend that bears watching is the overall amount of money being earned. Bob Elliott, Chief Investment Officer at Simplify Funds, points out that Social Security withholding slowed down late last year. Statistics can mislead, but money collected from paychecks shouldn't. He blames tepid labor force growth. Another culprit might be what sorts of jobs are being created. One at McDonald's is probably a lot less lucrative than a job at Microsoft or Morgan Stanley. Is AI to blame? Dario Amodei, CEO of Anthropic, predicted last year that the technology could eliminate half of all entry-level white-collar jobs in 5 years. Recent weakness in hiring seems to be hitting those roles, which traditionally requires a college or even a professional degree. Some employees do well initially and sometimes very well in later years. The median worker with a bachelor's degree earned 2/3 more than one with only a high school diploma in 2024. Those with a professional degree earned 1.5 times as much. Since the month before ChatGPT was introduced, the unemployment rate for Americans aged 20 to 24 with a bachelor's degree has risen to that of young adults who didn't attend college. Those who aged 50 to 54 have seen their unemployment rate drop over that time. Many in that cohort own homes and also have become much richer on paper from, you guessed it, AI-related stock market gains. Healthy nest eggs support consumer spending, but the wealth effect can turn sour a lot faster than the labor market. They're also connected. Poor job prospects for the young, educated workers could feed through to corrupt profits and eventually to stock prices. Walmart launches a healthcare network, by Kathleen Hamilton. Walmart launched Better Care Services, a digital network of healthcare providers, and will trim prices on some wellness-related products. The platform offers same-day consultation with third-party providers for urgent care and behavioral health, the company said Thursday. It also has access to LillyDirect, Eli Lilly and Company digital platform for managing diabetes, obesity, and migraines. Better Care Services also includes a nutrition hub, which includes personalized food and recipe recommendations powered by artificial intelligence, Walmart said. The company said it was reducing prices on more than 1,000 health-focused goods. The reductions include food, supplements, over-the-counter products, and fitness-related items. Uniqlo owner's net profit jumps 12%, by Kosaru Narioka and Ronnie Harui. Fast Retailing reported strong quarterly earnings and raised its annual guidance, playing down concerns about the possible impact of Japan-China tensions on its apparel business. The Japanese owner of Uniqlo said Thursday that revenue and profit increased across various regions for the 3 months ended November. Shares in the Tokyo-listed company have been roughly flat since mid-November, when China urged its citizens to avoid traveling to Japan amid the diplomatic spat. Fast Retailing on Thursday said its first quarter net profit rose 12% from a year ago to 147.45 billion yen, equivalent to $940.5 million. Revenue rose 15% to 1,028 trillion yen, Operating profit jumped 34% to 210.91 billion yen. Backed by strong sales, Uniqlo in the U.S. offset the impact of U.S. tariffs by limiting discounts and raising prices on some products. Uniqlo clothes are mostly made in countries such as China, Vietnam, Bangladesh, Indonesia, and India. In Europe, new store openings in cities such as Glasgow and Birmingham in the UK and Munich and Frankfurt in Germany proved a success. It also plans to open flagship stores in U.S. cities, including Chicago, New York, and Boston. In China, a key market where profit dropped in the previous fiscal year, a tie-up with e-commerce giant JD.com helped increase online consumer numbers and boost earnings. Chief Financial Officer Takeshi Okazaki said Thursday that there might be an impact on Chinese sales after Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi's recent comments on Taiwan, but added that the company's ability to meet customer demand and weather conditions are more important drivers of earnings. Takaichi enraged Beijing in November by saying that Japan could be dragged into a conflict to defend itself or allies such as the U.S. if China attacked Taiwan. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. On the technology page, LinkedIn's Secret, Real Names by Stu Wu. A lot of people are spending more time on LinkedIn. For years, the Microsoft-owned site was primarily a place to hunt for jobs and a punchline. It was a wasteland of corporate buzzwords, 4 a.m. wake-up routines, and stories about overcoming workplace adversity. Some of that remains, but the vibe has shifted. At 22, LinkedIn has become a bigger part of the lives of professionals and a thriving business. Revenue jumped to $17 billion in 2025 from $7 billion in 2020, and membership doubled to 1.3 billion. Users stick around. Americans checking LinkedIn more than once a day climbed to 4.7% last year from about 3.9% in 2020, according to research firm GWI. Design plays a part. The site emulated Facebook and TikTok by adding a news feed and videos. However, some new fans argue that the real attraction lies in the features LinkedIn hasn't changed. In particular, the requirement that users provide their real names. Research shows that real names curb toxicity. While not immune to misinformation and scams, LinkedIn lured people leaving X and Facebook as content moderation and fact-checking there declined. Instacart was questioned on price testing by Elias Shisko. New York Attorney General Letitia James is demanding that Instacart share information about its price-tested experiments following a report that the app's users were charged different prices for identical products from the same stores. In a Thursday letter to the company, James and Assistant Attorney General Ryan Galasuski requested copies of the company's pricing agreements with a range of retailers and food and beverage brands. Also on the technology page, Paramount defends its bid for Warner. Target previously said the offer wasn't even comparable to Netflix's deal by Jessica Tunkel and Lauren Thomas. Paramount Skydance continued pushing its $77.9 billion bid for Warner Brothers Discovery on Thursday, a day after Warner said it planned to stick to its existing deal with Netflix. Paramount's offer is superior to WBD's existing agreement with Netflix and represents the best path forward for WBD shareholders, Paramount said. Warner on Wednesday had told its shareholders in a public letter that Paramount's latest offer for the entire company wasn't superior or even comparable to its $72 billion agreement with Netflix. Netflix agreed in December to pay $27.75 a share in stock and cash for Warner's movie and TV studios and the HBO Max streaming service following Warner's planned separation of its cable networks later that year. The cable networks are poised to be housed in a separate publicly traded company called Discovery Global. On Monday, Warner rival Comcast spun out Versant, which includes many of its TV and media assets. Versant shares closed down 13% on their first day of trading. The stock rose 1.3% on Thursday. Paramount said on Thursday that Versant's disappointing performance so far illustrates the challenged path ahead for Discovery Global. Paramount said its analysis values Discovery Global at $0 a share, challenging Warner's assertion that the Netflix deal leaves its shareholders with upside in Discovery Global. Paramount also defended its sources of financing for the deal. The company has lined up the Bank of America, Citibank, and Apollo Capital Management to provide $54 billion in debt. Paramount said on Thursday that their commitment remains in full force and effect. Warner had said in its letter that a Paramount offer is, in effect, a leveraged buyout, given the amount of debt involved and Paramount's smaller size relative to Netflix. Paramount has a market value of around $13 billion, while Netflix is around $400 billion. Paramount launched its hostile bid in December after accusing Warner of not meaningfully engaging with it, even as it submitted multiple takeover proposals. Paramount had amended the most recent bid to include a personal guarantee from billionaire Larry Ellison, the father of Paramount Chief Executive Officer David Ellison, for $40.4 billion of equity financing. Paramount had also increased what is called the breakup fee it would owe Warner if regulators block its deal, matching Netflix's $5.8 billion figure. Warner rejected Paramount's initial tender offer last month. Warner shareholders have until January 21st to participate in Paramount's tender offer, though the deadline can always be extended. In business and finance, 7-Eleven owner lifts outlook, by Kosaku Narioka. 7&I Holdings raised its annual profit forecast after posting a sharp jump in third quarter net profits as it gears up for a listing of its North American business. The Japanese owner of 7-Eleven said Thursday that operating profit for its domestic convenience store business increased thanks to higher revenue in the 3 months ended November. Operating profit at its overseas convenience store business fell as gas sales at its North American business dropped. 7&I announced a series of measures last March to boost its shareholder value as it sought to head off Alimentation Couche-Tard's $47 billion takeover bid, which the Canadian owner of Circle K abandoned in July. The Japan-based company last year sold a group of superstores and other businesses for $5.4 billion and announced a plan to list its North American convenience store business by the end of 2026. The company is using proceeds from both to fund a $13 billion share buyback. 7&I said in December that Joe DePinto, who had served as chief executive of the North American business for more than 20 years, would step down at the end of 2025 and that the board was conducting a comprehensive process to find a successor. Chief Financial Officer Yoshimichi Maruyama on Thursday said internal and external candidates are being considered for the job. The 7-Eleven owner has been taking steps on its own to boost earnings, such as improving its earnings of proprietary and freshly made food items. 7&I reported third quarter net profit of 76.66 billion yen, equivalent to $489 million, a more than six-fold increase from a year earlier when restructuring-related losses hit the bottom line. Analysts polled by data provider Visible Alpha had expected net profit of 71.7 yen, billion yen for the latest quarter. Revenues, however, fell 20% to 2.434 trillion yen, partly due to the recent sale of superstores and other businesses. for the fiscal sale ending in February. The 7-Eleven owner projected net profit to climb 56% to 270 billion yen, up from its previous forecast of 265 billion yen. It reiterated expectations for revenue to decline 12% to 10.560 trillion yen. In markets, HSBC settles French claims of tax fraud for $313 million by Joshua Kirby. French authorities said lender HSBC agreed to pay a fine of nearly 268 million euros or $312.9 million in connection with an investigation into accusations of tax fraud relating to dividend payments. The case will be shelved with the payment of the fine, Pascal Prache, a French financial prosecutor, said in a release Thursday. HSBC, in response, said it was pleased to have resolved this matter. The settlement with the French court recognizes the bank's cooperation with the investigation, as well as the corrective measures it took to address the historic issues, HSBC said. We continue to remain focused on serving our customers. The investigation related to accusations that HSBC's French arm, between 2014 and 2019, engaged in trading transactions involving intra-group dividend arbitrage transactions to benefit from the exemption of taxes from such transactions, dealings with the prosecutor's office said amounted to aggravated tax fraud. And finally, back to world news. U.S. pushes ceasefire in Aleppo. Syrian government, Kurdish-led militia, both U.S.-backed, escalate conflict, by Jared Melson and Lara Seligman. The U.S. is working to contain a worsening clash between two of its military partners in Syria as the country's new government battles a Kurdish militia in the city of Aleppo. Lethal fighting raged on Thursday between the two sides in the divided city where Kurdish-led forces hold key neighborhoods. Thousands of civilians streamed out of the neighborhoods ahead of a fight that threatens to bring more pain to the battered country and distract from efforts to keep Islamic State contained. Syria's government is working to unify the country after overthrowing the Assad regime a year ago. It and its Turkish backers are frustrated by the failure to reach an agreement with Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, which controls the country's vast northeast, despite months of negotiations. Senior U.S. officials, including Presidential Envoy Tom Barrack and U.S. military leaders in the region, have been working to de-escalate the fight. U.S. officials said they are in contact with leaders from both sides and are pushing for a ceasefire. Aleppo was Syria's largest city before it was consumed by brutal fighting during more than a decade of rebellion and civil war that ended with the fall of President Bashar al-Assad's regime in December 2024. The violence poses a challenge for the U.S. military and the Trump administration, which have worked to integrate the SDF into Syria's new government, led by former rebel leader Ahmed al-Sharaa, who visited the White House in November and formally joined a U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State extremists. Ambassador Barrack continues to support and facilitate dialogue between Syrian government and the Syrian Democratic Forces, the State Department said. The U.S. has had a long-standing partnership with the SDF in the battle against the radical Islamic State militia, which long controlled a swath of Iraq and Syria before being territorially defeated more than half a decade ago by a U.S.-led coalition. The group is working to reconstitute itself and has launched an increasing number of ambushes and attacks across Syria. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the January 9th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. and Friday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Dasha. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the Buffalo Criterion, followed at 8 o'clock by the New York Times, and at 9 o'clock by Buffalo Spree. Stay with us for these readings and more throughout the day. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,